Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program, and Department of Veteran Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now the host of Minnesota Military Radio Hour, Tom Lyons.
Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm Tom Lyons. In today's show, we talk about the Minnesota 3M Military Support Network, and we take a look at Minnesota's military after Pearl Harbor. But before we get started, let's take a moment to remember one of Minnesota's own. Andrew Wilfert graduated from Rosemont High School in 1997. A member of the marching band, his classmates describe him as talented, kind, and an outgoing person. He joined the United States Army in 2009 as a military police officer stationed at the Schofield Barracks in Hawaii. In July of last year, his company began their deployment to Afghanistan. Specialist Andrew Wilfert died last Sunday in Kandahar Province, Afghanistan, when insurgents attacked his patrol with an improvised explosive device. He was 31 years old, and he will be missed. Now it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
Access to quality of child care remains a focal point of leadership and families across the armed forces and especially within the Minnesota National Guard. Military families face challenges that are not found in other work environments. The men and women of the Minnesota National Guard can be called on to deploy on short notice, making child care a difficult challenge. Programs are needed to support reserve component families while the service member is deployed. The increased global operational tempo means the Guard families with limited exposure to the military now have to deal with the likelihood of multiple or longer deployments. In order to meet these demands, we must advocate for benefits for families incurring childhood costs during deployments and be flexible in terms of the federal and state licensing that is required for such programs. As part of a federal initiative to increase child care availability and quality for military families, the Defense Department, Health and Human Services, as well as the Departments of Education and Agriculture, have been committed to forming new child care liaison positions. A pilot program designed to find more child care spaces for military families, more than 8,000 of which can be utilized where needed to support the changing needs of Guard and Reserve families. The Minnesota National Guard will continue as an advocate for efforts to reconcile federal child care accreditation and federal benefits with state accreditation requirements for child care providers. We must ensure that benefits made available by federal programs are available to reserve component families here in Minnesota. We must work to expand options and benefits available to Minnesota National Guard families given the persistent high tempo of our training and deployments.
Thank you, General Nash. You can link to the Adjutant General's blog, Facebook, and Twitter feed through MinnesotaNationalGuard.org/generallyspeaking. Joining us today are two of the founding members of 3M's Military Support Network, Sandy Masterson and Carl Fassbender. Ms. Masterson and Mr. Fassbender, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sandy, I want to start out this interview by talking about Gold Star and Blue Star moms. Can you explain that to me and our listeners?
I'd be happy to. When a family has a family member serving in the armed forces, they become a Blue Star family when that person is deployed. So, for example, when my son Connor was deployed to Afghanistan, I could have flown the Blue Star banner in my window had I been aware of the organization. Sadly, I wasn't aware of this until my son was killed in action. And at that point in time, the Blue Star mothers came to Connor's visitation and presented us with some materials. And this is when we learned we had become a Gold Star family. So you become a Gold Star family, in my case, a Gold Star mother, when you lose someone who's serving on active duty.
And Sandy, as our Gold Star mom, mm-hmm. You really turned this into something great at 3M. Can you tell us what came from this tragedy?
I can. The day that we were advised of Connor's death, one of the two officers that came to our door was Chaplain Morris. And since that time, I have been at a number of events with Chaplain Morris and had gotten to know him. And he looked at me one day and he said, Sandy, I've gone into a number of companies and talked to them about the many unmet needs of our military families, and I'd be happy to come and talk at 3M if you'd like to have me. So I went to work, and within a very short time, we had an invitation extended to him to come to 3M and talk with us during a lunch and learn session. It was at this time that he talked to us about the many unmet needs and really encouraged us to start a support organization to support our 3Mers, our 3M families who have family members in the service. We took his challenge and we started what we call our military support network, and it's really grown. We're proud of our organization and what we've done.
Carl, can you tell us about the goals of the 3M Military Support Network?
Yeah, so we have several different goals. Most importantly is to make sure that we're offering assistance to families of deployed military members, you know, because there's a lot of stress in a deployment, obviously. So assisting them, educating our employees about the military community and those who serve. We also are constantly trying to raise awareness of our group so that those that are serving our country or family members that work for 3M who have a family member serving our country will have somewhere to turn to if there's issues or if they just need support in general.
And Sandy, in addition to the internal support network for 3Mers, you're supporting a couple of initiatives outside.
I am. I've become connected with a number of other Gold Star families, and in fact, I'd like to go back real quickly and reference something. You had introduced this broadcast with the mention of Andrew Wilford's death. And Lori Wilford is one of my 3M fellow coworkers, and so she's the newest of our Gold Star mothers. As I think, though, about what our Gold Star moms have done as we've come together, we have started our military support network at 3M. Outside of that, though, I'm part of the Scoops for Troops event in raising funds, education funds for children of Minnesota's fallen.
And then you're also involved in supporting or serving the troops and another organization?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I really want to mention that. Within 3M, I'm very proud that within this past year, we have gotten the distinction of being an employee resource group. And as a part of that, we're able to give funds to organizations of our choosing, 501c3 organizations. And we support, as a corporation, the Minnesota Military Family Foundation, the MMFF, and Serving the Troops.
And Carl, have you been involved in the Serving Our Troops programs?
The MMMF program I've been involved in, but not the Serving Our Troops program, per se.
And what type of work are you doing with the MMFF?
So that was, as Sandy mentioned, so we were out on helping with the sponsorship of the, they had a golf outing last year, so 3M helped with that, and going forward, we're going to be hosting that golf outing at 3M Tartan Park. So that'll be an exciting event for next year, or actually 2011.
And as a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation and the chairman of the golf tournament, I'd like to thank 3M for hosting this year and for participating last year. It's a big event. It's our biggest fundraiser of the year. And, of course, all of the proceeds of the event go to support the families of Minnesota military personnel that get in some type of financial distress. So if anyone wants to help with that, they can go to MinnesotaMilitaryFamilyFoundation.org. We'll continue our conversation with about 3M's Military Support Network after a short break. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk 100.3 FM. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Today we're talking to two of the founding members of 3M's Military Support Network, Sandy Masterson and Carl Fassbender. And also joining the conversation today is the State Chair for Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, Paul Montine. Mr. Montine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Paul, can you tell us what the ESGR, the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, is about?
ESGR is a part of the Department of Defense, and we have been tasked to create a culture in the United States where employers appreciate their veterans, especially those serving in the Guard and Reserve Forces. We do this through education. We do it through awards and rewards, as well as informal mediation of problems between employers and employees.
Well, we've heard a little bit this morning about the 3M Military Support Network. And you're pretty familiar with that. I understand 3M was put in for a very prestigious award. Can you tell us about
that? They certainly have been put in for a prestigious award, and it will be given on April 4th at our annual banquet at the Prom Center.
And what is that award for, Paul?
It is normally we award things based on the employees who serve. In this case, 3M has such a broad base of service through their 3M Gold Star Mom program, for their support for the Family Foundation, for everything that they're doing. We couldn't go with just one little thing, so we had to make up a special award for them.
A special award for 3M?
Yes.
And I understand that the Freedom Award is the top national award. Can you tell us about that?
The Freedom Award is the top national award. Each state nominates a large employer, small employer, and a public employer. Minnesota is rather unique in that in the 15 years that it's been awarded, we have received five of them. I think our first went to Northwest, the state of Minnesota, Ryland, Holmes, UMC, and I'm going to miss somebody here, Allianz Life.
So Minnesota has received the national award five times.
Right.
That's pretty darn good.
It is.
And does 3M have a chance of being number six?
They do not this year, but we'll work on it next year.
We'll work on it next year. So the award that they're going to receive in April is the state award, is that
this
it?
This is a state award, although it is also a Department of Defense award, but it's awarded for their work within the state, not nationally recognized this year.
And I assume that those five that received national awards won the state award before they received the national.
They always get a nice little bronze eagle from the state before they get the crystal eagle from the Department of Defense.
Terrific. Sandy, a little loaded question here. How many employees does 3M have? And I know that a lot of the 3Mers have been deployed in the past. Can you give us any kind of idea how many?
Worldwide, we have something over 70,000 employees, with approximately half of that, maybe a little less than half, in the United States. At any point in time, we have only about 25 people deployed on active duty, although we have many more than that who serve in the Guard or Reserve.
And of those people, how many employees in Minnesota then for 3M?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to have that number for you. Say somewhere around 15,000.
Carl, you can jump in here anytime you want.
Yeah, I'm going with Sandy's numbers.
All right, we won't put you on the spot with that one. But for the families, at any given time, if you've got 25 or 30 families deployed, there is an internal support network, and if those families need anything, they start with you, don't they?
They do. We've been able to get into our human resource cycle so that as employees are deploying, they can let us know that they are deploying and that we can get in contact with their families. We have other avenues open for them to communicate to us if they're a 3M employee with another family who's deployed so that they can self-identify. This is private information, so they must self-identify. But then we get connected to them, build relationships with them so that if they need help, should that time arise, they can contact us and we'll be there.
Now, Sandy, I was at a special dedication last year, for an area at 3M for the Military Service Network. Can you tell me about that?
I believe the event that you're talking about is our dedication of our display wall.
Yes.
Believe that was it. I feel very fortunate to have been a part of putting together this display at 3M that allows us, through a video board, to present new information on an ongoing basis about those who are serving, about our veterans, about events that we're taking part in, or even things like this, awards that we've either been nominated for or have received. It's really an exciting opportunity. It also raises awareness within our organization and gives people a way to connect back to us.
And you've gotten great support for your military support network from the top on down, haven't
we
you?
We have. Our CEO, George Buckley, is our executive sponsor, and I'm very pleased that he asked to be our executive sponsor.
And Carl, do you have any new initiatives coming up this year to take care of the internally, the 3Mers that are going to be deployed? I'm assuming you're going to have some of the 34th Infantry must work for 3M.
Oh, right, the Red Bulls. Again, as Sandy noted, that they have to self-identify for us to work with them, or for us to even know that they're deploying. But once they do, we do assign one of our members to care for that family should they need assistance. That way they have a single point of contact into 3M. You know, and if it's an employee that's leaving, obviously the family member doesn't have direct access to 3M's information. So having that direct contact to a 3M employee for the family helps them out quite a bit. I want to point out that we do have three main events that we do at 3M, Armed Forces Day, Memorial Day, and Veterans Day. And that's another avenue that we use to build awareness for our organization and to help make sure people know that there's resources for them should they need it.
Carl and Sandy, it sounds to me like 3M's a leader in the nation for how corporate America should support military families.
Thank you.
You've done great work.
Thank you.
Paul, you have an annual event coming up on April 4th, I believe. Can you tell us about it?
We most certainly do. We'll have our awards banquet. We give out about 35 awards to employers who go above and beyond, who have been nominated by their reserve component employees. We pick those three special awards, our Pro Patria awards, our above and beyond awards, from that group of 35, and we award those at this as well. It's a special event. This year, we're happy to say we have General Craig McKinley coming to be our guest speaker. He is the four-star general in charge of the National Guard.
That'll be a great event for you. Ms. Masterson, Mr. Fassbender, and Mr. Montin, thank you for joining us today. That was Sandy Masterson and Carl Fassbender, two of the founding members of 3M's Military Support Network, and Paul Montin, State Chair of the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. We'll have links to more information on Facebook, especially the annual event for the SGR, and at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Each week, we feature Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, a comprehensive program that connects service members and their families with community support, training, services, and resources. Let's visit this week's Support Our Troops Showcase, a story where someone just like you and I went out of their way to make a difference in the life of a service member or military family. Last August, news came to the small town of Pine City that one of their own, 34-year-old Marine Master Sergeant Daniel Fetter, was killed by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. Immediately, community members thought of his mom, who worked at the DMV in town. Everyone remembered her as the nice woman who helped them renew their license or get their tabs. Now she was suffering. The Pine City Yellow Ribbon Network organizers scrambled into action. Days after the tragic news, the funeral for Dan was held at the Pine City Armory. When his family and friends left the service, they were greeted with overwhelming community support. There were people holding flags and wearing yellow ribbons. Friends and strangers lined the street, starting along the armory, all the way down Highway 61, and then all along 3rd Street, all the way to Birchwood Cemetery. They were all there to show their support. Dan's mom was taken aback so that many people cared. His whole family was very grateful that the community pulled together to support them in their time of need. Thank you to Pine City Yellow Ribbon Network for showcasing how Minnesotans strive to go beyond the yellow ribbon. Beyond the Yellow Ribbon connects service members and their families with organizations, agencies, companies, community support, training, services, and resources to bring service members all the way home. To learn how you can, like Pine City Yellow Ribbon Network, make a difference in the life of a service member or military family, visit beyondtheyellowribbon.org. When we return, we'll take a look at Minnesota's military after Pearl Harbor with Doug Becky. That's right here on News Talk 100.3. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Lyons. It's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelledo.
As I settle in my new role as Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, I am reminded of the highly trained, quality folks who have chosen to make it their career to help our nation's heroes. Recently, our Minnesota veterans' homes in Minneapolis, Fergus Falls, Hastings, and Laverne received awards from the Aging Services Institute of Minnesota for successful implementation of a fall prevention and reduction program. As a department, we are focusing in 2011 on telling our story. We want the public to understand more about our veterans' homes. These aren't just facilities, they are home to nearly 1,000 veterans across Minnesota. Minnesota's veterans' homes have a rich history. They began shortly after the Civil War as a reward to the brave and deserving. In 1888, crews broke ground for our first home in the state, located in Minneapolis. The mission then was to create beautiful landscape communities for veterans in their later years. They were monuments to the contributions of Minnesota veterans. Later, during World War I, medical care was also provided. Today, Minnesota operates 5 state veterans' homes. They are located across the state, providing 24-hour skilled nursing and dementia care, along with domiciliary care, also known as board and care. In 2007, the governor abolished the Veterans Home Board and transferred the 5 Minnesota veterans' homes to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. This was done to consolidate all state veterans services and programs into one department and to improve the services provided to Minnesota veterans. While details may have changed, our vision remains the same. We are focused on providing quality care for this country's heroes. Our move toward person-centered care is yet another way we can recognize and honor our veterans. We want them to be as involved in their care as they would be at home. After all, it is their new home. Updated facilities, staff training, education, and programming are all areas we have chosen to focus on in an effort to become one of the strongest veterans homes program in the country. To learn more about our veterans home in Minnesota, visit us online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Thank you, Commissioner Shalito. You can find out more about the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs programs by calling 1-888-LINK-VET or online at minnesotaveteran.org. This week, Doug Becky joins us. He is a Vietnam veteran and the curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. Mr. Becky, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Sir, before we start talking about World War II, can you tell us a little bit about the Minnesota Military Museum?
It's a great museum. It focuses on all Minnesota military units, all branches of the service, and all eras. And we've got a big exhibit coming up now that we're working on. It's on Minnesota and the Civil War. That'll be opening up on July 9th, so we're going to have an opening event that day.
And for our listeners that are traveling in northern Minnesota, the days and hours that's open again?
The museum, from May 1st to October 1st, is open 7 days a week from 10 to 5. And during the winter months, it's open from 9 to 4, Thursdays and Fridays, or by request.
So they just have to drive up to the main gate and ask to be passed through to the Minnesota Military Museum.
That's right. They'll probably have to show an ID or something, but it's not a problem at all to come in. Everyone's welcome.
Great. Now, Mr. Becky, on our show a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how Minnesotans fired the first American shot on Japanese forces just before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. Where did Minnesota Guard units go after that historic day?
Well, the first question on a lot of their mouths was, where is Pearl Harbor? And they got that settled, and then they were hit with the reality of no longer going home soon. They were in for the duration plus six months. The 34th Tank Company, which had been in the 34th Division, was sent to the Philippines, and they were in combat almost immediately when the Japanese attacked Clark Field, which they were responsible for guarding. The Air National Guard, the 109th Observation Squadron, was transferred around the southern United States for a few months, and then in September of 1942, they went to England, so they're one of the early air units to go overseas. The 101st Anti-Aircraft Coastal Artillery Brigade stayed in California, and they were guarding the Pacific coastline and installations along the coast. The big unit was the 34th Infantry Division at Camp Claiborne, Louisiana, and they were immediately sent out to the Gulf Coast to guard strategic locations and facilities along that coast and in the cities. But an interesting note that many of the soldiers mentioned to me when I interviewed them was that before Pearl Harbor, they were just these Yankees who were in the South and kind of unruly young men away from mom and the restraints of the home environment. And some even mentioned that they'd see signs on some of the lawns, dogs and soldiers keep off the grass. But immediately after Pearl Harbor, everybody was extremely friendly. Now they were the sons of America, and people would take them home for supper and bring them food, and everyone was very, very friendly with them. The unit tried to get everyone home on leave, and they went home in shifts. And so everyone, just about everybody in the division got home on some kind of a leave before they were shipped out. Not part of the National Guard, but important stories. You mentioned the Naval Reserve fired the first shot at Pearl Harbor off the USS Ward. And then the 3rd Infantry, which was the longest-serving regular Army unit at Fort Snelling, was sent to Newfoundland and Greenland in 1941. They were still there when Pearl Harbor happened.
And sir, what was the story? I understand you have a story of A Company of the 194th Tank Battalion.
Right. Well, A Company was the 34th Tank Company. When they were federalized, they became they stopped being part of the 34th Division, and they were formed with several other National Guard units into the 194th Tank Battalion. The A Company was mostly Brainerd men, and they arrived in the Philippines on the 26th of September, 1941. Their responsibility was to guard Clark Field. And so they were again in that initial attack when the Japanese started bombing the Philippines in preparation for that their invasion. After that, they moved up and down Luzon, fighting the Japanese and conducting covering operations for the withdrawal of U.S. forces. They had severe supply and shortages. When they engaged the Japanese for the first time, it was the first time that they fired their main guns. They had had no ammunition for training whatsoever, and they always had gasoline shortages, too. They fought a series of rearguard actions. They were the last unit to enter the Bataan Peninsula, having covered the withdrawal of all the other units going in on the 6th and 7th of January, 42. When Bataan surrendered on the 9th of April, 1942, the 194th was credited with having fired the last shots at the Japanese. They received a presidential unit citation for their combat operations. They participated in the Bataan Death March. 70% of the men, 65 to 70%, died in Japanese captivity or as a result of the war, some in combat, some on the death march, mostly in POW camps or on death ships. A lot of them were sent up to China and Japan, where they suffered horribly, really slave labor conditions in some of those camps. So it was a real heavy blow to the Brainerd community.
We're speaking with Doug Becky, the curator for the Minnesota Military Museum, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on News Talk 100.3 FM. Mr. Becky, right after Pearl Harbor, what was the mood in the state, and how many guardsmen did we have, and how did we mobilize?
Right. Well, the mood in the state was enlist today. And so immediately after Pearl Harbor, all the recruiting stations were filled up with people wanting to enlist in all kinds of the service. And there was a certain percentage of the population, especially younger people, who thought, well, you know, send in a few Marines and we'll clean this up and it'll all be over in no time. But it was a long, hard slog coming up. Now, most of the guard units had been dissipated somewhat as far as their Minnesota character. They started getting the draftees in and from around the country. And so they started to lose some of their Minnesota character. Also, the Minnesotans were being transferred out to other units, to schools. Some were going to officers training. Some were going to specialized training.
So did they pretty well drain the state of all the guardsmen?
Yes. I think just about the entire National Guard was mobilized and sent out. So back in the state, they formed the State Guard, and they fulfilled a lot of the functions of the National Guard for civilian emergencies. They do certain guard functions around the state. If there was a tornado, they'd go out for that. A flood, something like that, they were available for that.
And can you tell us where the 101st Anti-Aircraft Brigade served?
Sure. They were in California, and they stayed there. Most of them stayed there, guarding the coastline. One of their regiments, the 215th, went up to Kodiak, Alaska in July of 1941. And they stayed there till 1944. The 216th and 17th regiments stayed in California. And a lot of the guys were bored with this. There wasn't much going on. There wasn't really any threat to the coastline. And so a lot of them transferred to other units, and a significant number of them that, I've talked to went into paratrooper units where they saw more combat than they'd anticipated. A few of them went to OCS and other schools and that sort of thing. But eventually, by 1944, they had been reorganized into other units and pretty much lost their Minnesota character, too.
We'll continue our conversation with Doug Becky after a short break. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk 100.3 FM. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. We're talking today with Doug Becky, the curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. Doug, it seems like every time I talk to you, we trace the current 34th Red Bull Infantry Division back to somewhere. Can you track us through their combat record in World War II?
Sure. They first went to Northern Ireland and trained in Northern Ireland. They were the first unit sent overseas, in 1st American Division sent overseas in World War II. The first elements landed already in January of 1942, so just a little bit over a month after Pearl Harbor. The original Ranger Battalion was formed out of mostly out of the 34th Division, and on the 8th of November, elements of the 34th Division were among the very first units to land in North Africa. Two elements landing outside Algiers. One was called the Terminal Task Force, and the other was the 168th Infantry and the 175th Field Artillery. Within a few days after the landing, they were on their way to Tunisia, trying to beat the Germans into Tunisia. The Germans were reinforcing at a tremendous rate, too. And in Tunisia, the 175th Field Artillery was credited with firing the first American artillery round of World War II. Incidentally, we have the casing with all the names of the men engraved on it on display here at the museum. They continued to fight in North Africa. The rest of the division arrived in January. And they fought in many battles, Kasserine, Senad Station, 1st and 2nd Fonduc, and Hill 609 was their big battle, which winning that battle opened up the door to Bizerta and the end of the Africa Corps in North Africa. They didn't participate in the Sicilian campaign. One of their battalions, the 151st Field Artillery, was in on the initial landing at Salerno, supporting the 26th Division. And their role was vital because they were instrumental in stopping German counterattacks, stopping German tanks literally a few hundred yards from the beach. The 25th and 26th of September, the division landed in Italy. The main body of the division landed and then started their march up the Italian boot. They crossed the Volturno River three times. They went through the winter line, captured many towns all the way up to Cassino. And this is where they really got into some tough fighting. They attacked on the 25th of January through the 15th of February, 44. Elements of the division got right up to the walls of the monastery, but they just didn't have the reinforcements behind them to maintain the position, and they had to pull back a little bit. And, of course, the day they pulled out, the 14th, 15th of February, was the day the Abbey was bombed. And I don't think there was anybody sad about seeing the Abbey bombed at that time. The 25th of March, they went to Anzio. They participated in the breakout from Anzio on the march to Rome, which was captured on the 4th of June. And unfortunately for the men in Italy, the 6th of June, the D-Day landings happened, and all of a sudden, the Italian campaign and all the fighting that was going on there was the backwater. And they didn't get much attention after that because everyone was focused on Normandy and fighting in D-Day. That fall, they marched up to Pisa and Florence. They spent the winter outside Bologna. On the 15th of April, 45, they participated in the attack on Bologna and into the Po Valley. The Germans were retreating as fast as they could, trying to get out of Italy, and the units literally intermingled. That you'd find, sometimes you see pictures of mixed convoys, German and American vehicles, and nobody knew if to shoot or surrender or what to do. Right at the end, the 34th Division accepted the surrender of the German 34th Division in northern Italy. By the end of the war, they'd amassed six campaign stars. They had 517 days in combat, the most of any U.S. division. One of their battalions, the 175th Field Artillery, had 610 days in combat, the most of any battalion in the Army. They captured the most mountains. There were 11 men in the division who won the Congressional Medal of Honor. but it came at a heavy cost. They lost over 3,700 killed, over 14,000 wounded, and they had 3,400 missing in action, mostly POWs from North Africa. They spent some time on occupation duty, then departed Naples, the division headquarters, greatly depleted now, departed Naples on the 22nd of October. They came back to the United States, and on the 3rd of November, the division was deactivated.
Mr. Becker, we've got about 30 seconds left. What was the homecoming like for these Minnesota Guardsmen?
Well, it wasn't like most people think. I think the best movie I can recommend to learn about the homecoming from World War II is The Best Years of Our Lives, the best picture of the year in 1946. Most of them came home in ones and twos, quiet reception, no brass bands, no cheering crowds, some hostility. You guys are coming home, you're going to take our jobs, you're going to take our houses, you're going to take our women. You know, 16 million, 10 million people coming home all of a sudden to the United States. And most of them just wanted to get on with their lives. And through the GI Bill, many were able to get tremendous educational opportunities. The United States had no economic competition in the world. Every other country was devastated. And so there were lots of opportunities, too. But they came home to a quiet reception in most cases.
Mr. Becky, as usual, it's been fascinating. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. What a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. That was Doug Becky, the curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. We have links to more information on Facebook and at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Let's take a look in the mailbag to see the listener question of the week. If you have a question, submit it to MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Joining us in the studio is Sergeant First Class Melanie Nelson from Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. Sergeant Nelson, what's in the mailbag today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I have a question here from Eden Prairie, it looks like. She writes, my son will be deploying in May, and I want to get involved to support other military families during this deployment. I've heard about Yellow Ribbon networks popping up around the state of Minnesota. Is there an active Yellow Ribbon network in Eden Prairie?
Very good question.
And
the answer?
Well, the answer to her specific question is there is an active Yellow Ribbon network in Eden Prairie. It has not yet been proclaimed a Yellow Ribbon city yet by our governor, but I am sure it will be very soon. They're doing fantastic things in Eden Prairie.
And can you tell us how the family assistance centers and the Yellow Ribbon networks interact?
I certainly can. As a matter of fact, Tom, for anyone else who's wondering if their communities are a Yellow Ribbon Network, the place to go is the Family Assistance Center. We have 14 Family Assistance Centers scattered throughout the state of Minnesota. 11 of them are they're Army National Guard based, but Family Assistance Centers serve every single service in Minnesota. And there are three Air Wing Family Assistance Centers. They range from Bemidji to Camp Ripley, Detroit Lakes. We've got one in Duluth, Mankato, Marshall, Rochester, Rosemount. We have a Family Assistance Center in St. Cloud, and our final one is in Stillwater. And by visiting, but it's much easier to just go to the website, beyondtheyellowribbon.org. If you click on our Family and Wellness tab and then click on the Family Assistance Center, you can get all this information, the addresses, the phone numbers, the email address for our staff that work at those centers. And then you just ask them, where is my Yellow Ribbon network? Or do I have one and how can I get involved? And they have that answer.
And if they'd like to find out different types of things they can do to help support the troops, they go to?
They go to beyondtheyellowribbon.org and click on the Make a Difference button right on the homepage. And there we have some suggestions for you on how you can adopt a unit, how you can get involved with military families and service members and other organizations throughout the state that support service members every day.
Very good. Great job, Sergeant Nelson. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
If you have a question, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us on Facebook and at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, our Gold Star mom, Sandy Masterson, and Carl Fassbender from 3M's Military Support Network, Paul Montine from the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, Doug Becky from the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley, Commissioner Larry Shelado, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about the United States Naval Reserves in Minnesota, and we'll talk to a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross. That's next Sunday morning at 7, right here on News Talk 100.3 FM. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm located in Minneapolis. He's also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force. We hope you found this program to be informative and entertaining. This has been a production of KTLK, Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. Podcasts of this program are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Thanks for listening.